With all the stuff we have to do in our lives, it makes sense sometimes that you can question whether or not there's any point to practice, you know, because there just seems like you're just following the breath, and it's sort of like, well, what is the point of that? And I think right effort, what we're going to talk about tonight, can kind of help put a framing around why we need to practice no matter what's going on. So for those of you, this is your first time, I'm just going to give you a little quick overview for understanding where right effort falls in the practice. And really, I think the Buddhist practice is the Four Noble Truths. I mean, it's Four Noble Truths, and in connection to that, it's understanding conditionality. So you begin to understand that things happen in a conditional way, that we move out of habit, and we move out of conditions, and we keep doing the same things over and over and over and over and over and over and over, even when we really don't intend to anymore. And for those of us, any of you online in the room who have actually changed the habit, you know how hard that was. You know how long and arduous that task is, because our mind-body system is designed for us to just follow habit and don't think about it. Just do things in this very habitual way. This is our, I guess you could say it's our go-to energy. And if the go-to energy was good enough for us to be happy, then Buddha wouldn't have had to even search out for awakening. You wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have spent 30 years trying to find the breath and follow the breath. I have plenty of other things I could have did. But there is a reason that the Buddha ended up following this path towards awakening, and for the awakening that he stumbled upon 2,700 years ago, that we follow that path. It's because this ordinary way of thinking and moving through the world, even though it's very kind of sleepwalking, you don't really have to think about it, it comes with a heavy price. It comes with a lot of struggle and a lot of pressure and a lot of pain. And for many of us who have actually changed a habit, like you stop drinking, you stop using drugs, or you actually just stop drinking so much coffee, or you change the way you eat, or all kinds of these habits, all these coping skills that we kind of grew up just doing it because we thought that's the way to do it. Then you get older and you realize it's not so supportive. You start changing your habits. You look back on that habit that you changed and you're like, yeah, I'm glad I did that. I'm glad I spent 30 years trying to figure out why in God's name we would ever try to follow the breath. I'm glad I did that because I am a lot stiller and a lot happier for it. So I'm glad that the Buddha took the time to understand and figure out what was the end of suffering. So his end of suffering is not the end of difficulty. I still have a lot of difficulty. It's not the end of pain. I have plenty of that too. So it's not the end of what it means to be human. It's the end of the suffering around that difficulty and having the capacity to bear it, right? We can bear it. And to be human is difficult, but we can bear it. And we don't have to bear it with this added layer of just misery. That is what this Eightfold Path is all about. And to learn how to do this takes a willingness to sit still and watch how the mind actually operates. That's really what we're doing when we meditate. We're learning to watch how the mind is operating. So when I first started meditating, if I got lost in thinking, I thought I was doing something wrong, as if I was making myself think or making myself not think. I don't have any control over it any more than I have control over what the ears hear or the eyes see. We just don't have that kind of control. So instead, I begin to learn that I am sitting here watching how the mind operates. And not a good mind, bad mind, just watching how the mind operates. And the framing that the Buddha put that watching the mind operate, the framing he used was the Eightfold Path. So he used this framework that has right view, so you begin to watch your opinions about things. You watch how the mind is viewing whatever you're doing. You practice this when you're just sitting there meditating, watching how the mind's viewing the situation. Nothing's happening. You're just sitting there. And it's amazing how many stories we can come up with. And the body actually feels like you're doing and moving and doing something, but you're not doing anything. You're just sitting here. So learning to see the view that the mind has and how it's pushing and moving us, that is within this little frame that we're going to begin to see. Right intention, you begin to have this intention. Right intention would be how harmonious are we with harm, non-harming, being kind, and having a bit of restraint. So we could sit here and just be lost in thought and don't think nothing of it. And I've spent many, many meditation periods in that state. I've spent many meditation periods completely asleep until the bell rings. I've spent many meditation periods, you know, right there with the breath, moment by moment by moment by moment. I've spent all these different types of ways of being in meditation. But I always have this intention to be present, to restrain and to practice, to be kind, to do no harm, and just to sit here and see if I can steady my attention. And sometimes it works out great and sometimes it doesn't. But the intention is always there over and over and over and over and over. So this is the wisdom part of this Eightfold Path, learning to set your intention and watch how you're viewing what's happening. And then there's this whole ethical conduct part, which is our conduct, which is whether or not we live within the precepts, which are five, not rules, but five training gauges. Doing no harm, not taking anything that's not freely offered, not lying, watching our sexuality so we don't have misconduct, and not overusing alcohol, drugs, TV, food, whatever our intoxication of choice is, not overdoing it. And that we start living by that, watching our livelihood, not cheating, not stealing, not misrepresenting ourselves, even in work or volunteering, and watching our speech. So there's just watching our conduct, watching our speech, how we talk to each other, how we talk to ourselves. And then the last part, which is where we are now at the end of the year here, is our meditative practice. It starts with right effort, and it goes to right mindfulness, right concentration. So just to clarify, this word right does not mean right versus wrong. This is the right way versus the wrong way. One way you could think of it is, if you're trying to liberate the mind from that added layer of misery, then the Eightfold Path is the right way to do it. Or another way, my favorite way that I've come to understand from Ajahn Pasano, is that the word right, it's translated as right, but the word is sama. And sama is a musical word. So it means harmonious. So it's not right so much as it is, it's harmonious or in keeping or attuned with what it is that we're doing in practice. So all of these path factors are attuning us towards the Dhamma, attuning us. So when you think about right effort, we are not trying to force something to happen. We are trying to learn what kind of effort would tune us towards the Dhamma, tune us with this harmonious way of being in the Dhamma. So I want to read a quote from Philip Moffat. He started a retreat earlier this week, and this is the quote he gave as part of his retreat description. He said, we have this unnoticed assumption that we have to contract to move, right? We have to physically pull up, do something, that we have to effort and strain and tighten to respond to life. But the Dhamma is teaching us something else. That responsive energy, when it's coming from a discerning mind, just moves. So a discerning mind, you could think of as this right view, right intention, this sama, harmonizing view, harmonizing your view towards Dhamma, harmonizing your attention towards Dhamma, harmonizing your conduct towards Dhamma. So this responsive energy that is coming from the discerning mind just moves. It's natural. There's no selfing in it. There's no extra tension. The wisdom knows, the compassion holds, and the action happens. It's just this learning to attune, and this same kind of habit energy that is very natural for this mind-body system, it begins to move within the framework of Dhamma. So you begin to move through life, same movement, same scenario, with less constriction and contraction and more guide, just guiding, gliding through, not walking on water gliding, but more like it's effortless. So you can roll with the punches. Think of it like that, you know? You can roll with whatever happens. You can be with it. And when sad stuff happens, you can be sad. And when happy stuff happens, you can be happy. Angry stuff happens, you can be angry. You can be emotionally available and engaged with life in life's terms. Not angry when you could be happy because you're afraid that the happiness won't last. Not irritated when you could be peaceful, but You're so used to being irritated all the time. It just shows up all the time. And you don't even notice it, but you're just irritated all the time. So you can learn to move in the world in right relationship, harmonious with the phenomena and the experiences that you're having. You see where we're at here. So the framing that we do all this in is right effort. We learn to apply this harmonious effort. So this harmonious effort, it has to be framed within the context of your attitude. Without the sort of harmonious attitude, without a particular type of attitude, then this right effort will not make any sense. So the frame, the four sides of the frame that you do your practice in, one, there has to be an upbeat about practice, a desire to practice. There has to be some degree of upbeat. It just seems weird, I know. Because mostly when we're practicing, it feels pretty miserable. It doesn't feel upbeat. I know. You can really see it when you do a long retreat. The people who come to the retreat are all excited and upbeat and they can't wait to start. And the people who are leaving the retreat, they're all upbeat, ready, can't wait to go home. And the people who stay over, they walk around looking miserable. Our practice is, I don't know if it's the Western mind, I don't know what it is, but there is this misery that's associated with practice, as if somehow or another, the drudgery of it is what's supposed to, I just gotta bear it and get through this and somehow I'm gonna be happy on the other end. When I eventually stop practicing, then I'm gonna be happy. It's not like that. We have to learn that whatever we see, good, bad, indifference, is all good. It's all good. It's all practice. And whether we see our bad habits, which mostly is what we see, or we see our good habits, which we see it, but we don't dwell on it. We dwell on the bad habits instead of the good ones. But we all do good things and we all do bad things. It's all just part of being human. So having an upbeat relationship with practice, what we're actually doing is learning how to be okay with all of it. All of it. Because whatever, when you're a practitioner, it doesn't matter what you see, because what you see is not who you are. What you see is maybe a moment in time that you're seeing, but who you are is an ever-flowering, growing capacity. So if I judged my practice based on when I first started, I wouldn't be sitting here because I was a hot mess. I couldn't practice. Many of you know I would put the bench in the hallway between me and the bathroom so that I would have to pass that bench and sit down. And inevitably, I would walk right past it, never see it. And then I'd get in the bed later on that night and I'd be like, I was going to meditate today. I just never can remember. It's just not an easy thing that we're taking on. It's difficult to sit and watch the unfolding of who we are and how we are, I should say, not who we are, but how we are. And so having an upbeat framing, this is all practice. and having a kind of humorous, jovial way of approaching it makes all the difference in the world. Secondly, you have to have a sense of this willingness to completely mess up. You have to have a willingness or allow yourself permission to fail. This concept that we fail is very hard for us as practitioners. It's like probably the first few practice meetings at a retreat we spend as teachers helping people be okay with constantly seeing themselves fail. I keep falling asleep. So, okay, that's all right. You just happen to notice that you're falling asleep, but you just stay with it. Eventually, you will stop falling asleep. But somehow, if we see ourselves falling asleep, we think we're doing something wrong. But we are not falling asleep. The mind is bored, doesn't understand it's falling asleep. And so learning to have this sense of, oh, I fell asleep during that meditation. That's okay. We'll just do it again tomorrow. We'll just start all over again. Doesn't really matter, because eventually the mind will understand what you're doing. It will understand and you will not fall asleep. And then some sit will happen and you're sitting there and you tumble into some space. And you're wondering, how did I get here? This is fantastic. This is what I'm practicing for. This is what I want from now on. But we can't make it happen because we have to just keep practicing. And the mind figures out. It puts the dots together, figures out what's happening. And it stops falling asleep. Not me, not you. It stops falling asleep. So we have to keep putting it in the position to learn how to not fall asleep. And our right intention, right view, right effort, right conduct, all of this is just part of this constantly trying it again, trying it again, trying it again. So we have that framing. And then the third thing, there's four parts of this frame. You got to have an upbeat attitude. You got to have this willingness to fail. And then you have to have this willingness to begin again. Fail, begin again. Fail, begin again. This willingness to keep at it. Because habits don't change because we want them to. They change because of our persistent beginning again, every time I fail, begin it again. Every time it falls off, begin again. Just this constant persistence over and over and over. Instead of it being about you, which probably the most liberative part of Buddha's understanding was his recognition of non-self. Because he was raised in a world, like we are raised in a world, where there is a self. And the idea was, even in his world, you are responsible for everything that happens to you. And if you don't take care of yourself, if you don't get it right, it's your fault. You did something wrong. And anybody that's not successful, it's their fault. And so there's this pressure that we all live under to be a certain way, to reach a certain point, to do it the right way. And what the Buddha realized was that he had very little control over what happened. All he had control over is this willingness to begin again, to begin again, to begin again, to have this upbeat attitude. And every time it did not flow, he would begin again, begin again, begin again. He had the epitome of failure because when he left home, you think about it, he left home, left his wife and brand new baby, and didn't sort of talk it through together. This would be the choice I'm going to make. No, he snuck out in the dead of night when everybody else was asleep. He snuck out and left to go and find himself. Left his wife and the baby and family and everybody. Nobody knows where he's at. He just sneaks out. That is not, that's not the way we move through the world. But he had to, because given his life and the expectations placed upon him, no one would have let him go. He wouldn't have been able to just walk away. So he sneaks out. But you know, even in our own lives, when we have went against the grain, parents don't want us to do something, totally going against the family. When I became a Buddhist, it was totally against my family. But I still felt like this is what I was supposed to do. So I had to keep it under wraps. I had to keep it quiet. And he had to sneak away. But I know just from being a human being that he had regret when things weren't working right. When he went to these great teachers and they were not helping him end his suffering. He was still suffering. He could get in deep concentration, but he was still suffering. He was still having the same, probably the same mental thoughts of regret. And should I go back home? Did I do the right thing? Maybe I should just go back home. Or, you know, still having pain, still having difficulties. That didn't work. He goes off and he does the, you know, deep ascetic practices. He's just going to bear through the pain. That didn't work. He was just dying. He wasn't getting anywhere. So here he's at the epitome of failure. He doesn't, the concentration doesn't work. The bear the pain, that doesn't work. And so in the midst of all of this, he had to begin again. That's what he did. He began again, tried something else. And he just kept beginning again, trying something else, beginning again, trying something else. And it turns out that both the meditative stillness, the wisdom of watching what was happening, and this alignment of his conduct, that that process of watching his conduct, watching the view and the intention he had around practice and this right effort, his meditative practice, that those eight qualities clicked in and he found the path. And so that's why he came out and started talking about the Eightfold Path. So this beginning again, last part of the frame is having this intention to practice. Not just the upbeat, but not just the upbeat of it, not just the willingness to fail, not just the act of beginning again, but this intention to practice. Whatever it looks like, it's just that sometimes it looks good and you're all upright and it looks steady, and sometimes it's sloppy. You're just sitting on the bus waiting, like, okay, so just hearing sounds, you know. Waiting in the doctor's office. It has all kinds of ways. But if you know it to be practice, I intend to practice. I intend to have practice part of my life. However I can shove it in, fit it in, then you're in the right framing for right effort. When you have that framing, now right effort is going to make sense. Because what I'm about to tell you of what right effort is, it won't make any sense outside of this framing that this is something you want to do. Because right effort, so harmonious effort with practice, is four parts. You abandon whatever unskillful you see, whatever arisen unskillful you see, you prevent unskillful from arising, you cultivate skillful action, unskillful actions, you abandon it, and then prevent any unskillful actions from arising. You cultivate skillful actions, and you sustain any skillful actions you see. That's it. So in any moment, you are doing one of those four things. In any moment, if you notice you're doing something unskillful, the idea is not to dwell on that unskillfulness. You let it go. You just see there's unskillfulness, you let it go. But trying to just let go of unskillfulness is not the easiest thing to do, because a lot of that unskillfulness is what the mind wants to do. So you have to intentionally cultivate unarisen skillfulness. Right? So this is why we use the breath or an anchor or metta. So you have all this anger show up. You want to abandon that anger, but it's not going away. But you can also notice you don't have any skillfulness here. Anger has, you know, anger is not bad, but if you don't be careful with anger, you can create a lot of harm. So you want to cultivate some skillfulness. And you can cultivate patience. You can cultivate metta. You can cultivate some kind of do no harm, no matter, okay, Tori, I know you're angry, but don't do any harm. Pay attention to what you're doing here. So you can cultivate skillful. And as you're cultivating skillful, you will gradually abandon the unskillful. The Buddha said, in reliance on this, you will abandon that. So you want to abandon the unskillful, but part of what helps you abandon it is the cultivation of skillful. But he says one more thing. So when you cultivate skillful, one little flickering flame, like you're blowing to try to get the fire started, trying to get the fire started, you see a flicker, you have to blow on it. You have to dwell on your good conduct. Dwell on it. This is the strangest thing for a Western mind to grasp. No way we're going to dwell on our good conduct. Mostly if we do something good, it's like, it's okay. It's not that big of a deal. He's like, no, dwell on it. Dwell on it. So the way I learned that this really is important is that I was a lawyer, so I always had this idea that I'm always right. And I'm Virgo, so I am always right, but that's a whole other level. So, but because I thought I was always right, the idea of listening to someone else never made any sense to me. Never made any sense to me, because it would be like I'm listening to someone who's wrong. Why would I do that? So mostly, I just pressured people to do what I wanted, because I'm not trying to be mean, but I think I've got the right way. So when I began to want to, I set this vow to restrain. My restraint was not having to get my way. All right, that was my vow. I don't have to get my way. So If I wanted something and I started feeling myself pushing, then that's me trying to get my way. I need to have some restraint and let it go. But it's funny. This is the abandoning, right? The abandoning of unskillful conduct. Because nobody wants to be pressured into doing it your way, even if it's right. So I could feel the harm in what I was doing. I could feel the unskillfulness in this pressuring people to do it my way. And I wanted to abandon it, but I was always stuck in this idea that I was going to have to do something that I thought was wrong. And then I came up with a great idea. I would, as an act of generosity, I would let someone have their way. That would be my generosity. That's my gift to you. You can have your way. And then at night, I would dwell on how many times I let someone, out of the generousness of my heart, let them have their way. I'm telling you, it was unbelievable, my ability to stop forcing people to have my way, to do it my way. Because by dwelling on this generosity, eventually the mind preferred the felt sense of ease that came with letting someone else have their way than the harm of pressuring, pushing, trying to make people do it my way. Can you see that? So this abandoning began to happen, not because I just abandoned it, but because I cultivated this skillful means of being generous, and then I dwelled on how generous I was, how wonderful a person I am. Oh my God, I can't believe it. I'm so happy to be me. That dwelling goes completely against our grain. It's completely against this Western mind, that we would dwell on our good conduct. But this is important, that when you notice any goodness that you do, you dwell on it, you sustain it, you remember it, you make a big deal about it. You don't go to bed at night, you don't go to sleep until you have dwelled on your good conduct, your good habits, the things that you did that were good. Because you're trying, what we do is we want to see ourselves as good people, but we dwell on all our negativity. Can you see that? That's what we dwell on, is everything we do wrong. And then we have a hard time ever believing we are of any value. But if you dwell on the slightest good thing that you do, you will begin to show the mind your good qualities. And the mind will lean towards good qualities more than it will the bad ones. Mostly because the mind believes the bad ones is helping you. So you got to remember not to mess up like this again. Or the mind is convinced that if I do it somebody else's way, I'm going to be doing some harm to myself. So I have to force people to do it my way just so there won't be any harm. Do you see? So the abandoning comes with the cultivation of good. So whatever unskillful behavior you have, see if you can think of a counterbalance that would be good, right? So, you know, let's say that you get irritated by people all the time. You know, you don't like waiting on people or whatever. You get irritated at people. Then your counterbalance could be this offering of people patience so that they can, you know, have a little more time to, you know, whatever, take your time. But and then when you lay in the bed, you're like, oh yeah, I let that person have more time. I let that person get in front of me. I let that person came in and look at how good I am. Dwell on that. And before you know it, your mind will naturally begin to just give. And then what you want to cultivate of patience, it'll start happening simply because you use the times you're irritated as an opportunity to practice patience. You see? So you're cultivating skillful and you're dwelling on it every time you do it. And that supports the abandoning and the preventing it from arising again. Because you begin to see, the mind begins to see, that constant irritation is causing you more grief than it's causing anyone else. And gradually, it will prevent its arising. So but in order to do this, you can see you got to have this framing that you're just practicing. There's no good, bad, the right way, wrong way to do it. It's all part of practice. And whatever you see, you're just using it as an opportunity for practicing. This is what right effort is. And it's usually held in the context of mindfulness and concentration. So next week, we're going to talk about right effort in relation to our meditative practice. I just wanted to set the framing because the exact same framing is what we're going to use when we're meditating. But you have to sort of get a sense of why this matters. So to help you see this, let's say you're miserable. You're just, I just want to be right. I mean, I just want to be a great person. I don't want to have any bad habits. I want to get rid of all these bad habits. I want to be just, a nice person. I want to be awakened, enlightened. I want all this, right? But you don't put it in the framing of this upbeat willingness to begin again and the frame itself. You say, oh, right effort. Okay, I'm going to abandon the unskillful and I'm going to cultivate the skillful and I'm going to sustain when I see any skillful and prevent its unskillful from arising. You will never see any skillful. And if you see it, it'll be a flicker and it'll be like, too bad, I didn't catch it. Okay, I can't dwell on it because it was here, it was gone, it was so insignificant anyway. But I'm so bad. That's what you will cultivate, all this this arisen unskillfulness, you will cultivate it. And you will pretty much abandon all of your skillful behavior because you will not have the capacity to dwell on it. So you have to frame it in this upbeat energy so you're willing to not get tripped up by all the unskillfulness that you see. Because you will see a lot of unskillfulness. But within that unskillfulness is the skillful. That's what you want to encourage yourself. So that's a lot. We'll stop here and take a moment and we'll see if there's any questions about this general practice. And then next week I'll be back and we'll talk about it in relation to actual meditation. All right, so let's just take a moment here. Right. Thank you so much for your kind attention. See. see if there's any questions or comments. Oh, good, we have one in here. Oh, there's one right behind you first, and then we'll come in front.
Thank you, Trori. And
thank
I always
you.
Love how you share from your own life. I remember that you've talked in the past about the trauma in your childhood, and I think that kind of really led to your fighting spirit.
That's right, it does.
And I think about, like, I've been, you know, revisiting the trauma responses, the adrenaline responses, fight, fright, flight.
And freeze. Mm-hmm.
Freeze and fawn and flop. I have just recently realized, I feel like it's a total revelation, but that I have a habit of the fawn response.
I don't know what the fawn is.
I will tell you. So if you think about, for example, a dog who has been abused chronically, and how they act around their owner, and they're low to the body, ground, they wag their tails, they don't make eye contact, but they are doing everything they can to please you.
Yes, yes, yes.
And it's a false friendliness.
Yes.
So that they won't be abused. Right.
Yes, yes.
And so I see, like, now in my life, like, so many ways that I do this. I accidentally invited my dad on a vacation and to stay in our hotel room.
Wow.
And I'm like, oh my, I was told, oh, that was the fawn response.
Yes.
And I'm like, I'm 50 and I'm still doing this. And I'm like, oh. And so the habit, like, I see, how I am just, that habit is so ingrained. And when you talk about seeing the virtue in doing the opposite of what I am doing, I was wondering if you have had experience with people who are like me.
Bonnie.
And how to kind of, I am actually a lawyer. And I'm a litigator, and I hate conflict, and it's so hard for me to be the way you are.
Yeah.
And for me, the actually to have my own way would be the virtue, I think. So, anyways,
yes.
I love your thoughts.
Oh wow! So I think, let me think here. I'd look at the paramis here. So resolve is a paramis, right? And a paramis is, they're called paramis. They're called the 10 perfections. So there are 10 qualities of a heart energy that resonates, that helps us stay with the path. So of those 10, generosity is one of them. That's the one I picked on the side. But for fawning, it would seem like you would need some degree of resolve, some degree of determination. That's one, right? Or the other one I was thinking of was truthfulness, right? So when you fawn and then you see it, the conduct you want to dwell on is, I can see this. Oh, look at me here, seeing the fawning. Oh, I see what this is, because you're dwelling on the good, skillful conduct of seeing it, not dwelling on, not hating that you're doing something. You're dwelling on the seeing of the truth of it. And I guarantee you, the more you see it with this upbeat, a kind of attitude of, oh yes, I see what's happening, the more you will see that the recognition of that fawning is more important than the actual doing it. Because fawning only works if it's like freeze or flight or fight. It only works if you don't see yourself doing it. It doesn't work when you see yourself. So the fact that you see it, it's more thinking of that as truthfulness. And that truthfulness is going to be a liberative quality. The point is, though, you can't judge how long this takes. You can't do it that way because it's not a, you don't actually have any control over it. That's why you have to put it in that framing. You just begin again, begin again, begin again. So every time you see yourself in one of these trauma responses and you acknowledge it, that becomes your gift of the kind of, you know, the willingness to see the difficulty of it. That would be the resolve, is to see what this does to you. And the truthfulness is just the admitting of the truth of it, of what it is. But that actually becomes your cultivating skillful. Do you see? Yeah. And I have a feeling, if it's anything like the way it was with me, I could feel myself forcing someone to give me my way. I could feel it before I would even know that I'm doing it. You just begin to feel the fawning itself. And as you begin to feel it, you will gradually prevent its arising because you can feel it. But mostly we can't prevent its arising because we don't feel it. It's so habitual. We're in it. And so once you're in it, then believe me, I was not generous before. I was always generous when I was in the middle of a fight and I could feel the pressure. Then I would give it up and let them have it. And that's why it was this generosity that I was doing. It wouldn't be generosity if I just let them have their way before I even, you know, gave. I mean, I had to give. I had to let go of something I was entitled to. Do you see? So that's what you're doing. You're acknowledging that this is what's happening. And look how great you are that you can see it. Yeah? Good. Down in front.
Well, it's kind of already been addressed, but I'll say it anyways.
Okay.
So in my life, I've also like been a, you know, someone who defaults to fawning their way out of situations. But I've reached a point where I'm like, it's just like, or I'm just so fixated on what a horrible way to be that is. You know, how much of the self is compromised that I guess I've sort of become like, you know, the one to show myself that like, oh, I can break out of that, you know, so I'm just gonna be an asshole. That isn't even different.
No, it's not very much different.
Yeah.
That's part of the flopping, right?
Yeah.
That's the problem, is because we're not really losing or letting go of our habit. We mm-hmm. haven't really let go of it. So even with the, So you may have let go of the fawning and you've picked up this anger. When you see yourself or when you feel yourself just being an asshole, then that you can cultivate like kindness, right? You don't even have to be kind to the person that you're having all the negativity towards. You can be kind to anything. You could be kind to the trees outside. You could be kind to blades of grass. You can just be kind. Just be kind. I used ants. That's what helped me. I would just line up rows of ants and imagine myself sending the ants metta. But that cultivation, the first ants, they kind of had it rough because I was screaming at him. But as they went along and more ads would come trembling, I would get nicer and nicer and nicer, and gradually I'd find my kindness again. So you don't, this is not about you cultivating, like, do I have to be nice to this person that I just was a jerk to? You don't have, it's not that. You're not trying to fix yourself. You're trying to see, oh, I'm being a jerk. I need to cultivate kindness. So what can I find that I can be kind with? And I found that human beings, I had a hard time being kind. But leaves and plants and ants, I can do it. And so it's just about cultivating kindness. So you have to look for anything and everything you can think of to be kind, and cultivate it, cultivate it, cultivate it. And eventually your mind-body system is going to feel what it's like when you're cultivating kindness and what it's like when you're being an asshole. And that wisdom right there is what's going to help your mind choose kindness over the asshole. And it won't go immediately back to fawning. It will choose the distinction, because one is cultivated skillfulness and you're dwelling on that. And the other one is unskillfulness, and we do it by habit. But what we're doing is to, we're not doing it to hurt people. We're doing it to not hurt ourselves. And it ends up causing us more pain in the long run. That's why it's unskillful. So instead, you want to cultivate kindness, but find something that you can use to be kind with that you won't get tumbled up into, whether or not it's deserving. Do you see?
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good. Let me get a couple of hands here online, and then we'll get to you. Claire?
Hi, Tori. Thank you so much for the talk. So I don't have a question. I just have a comment.
Okay, great.
It was so interesting. The talk that you gave was like so spot on with what's been going on with me. It's kind of eerie almost. But so I did the day long that was this past Saturday at Sims, and it was really amazing. And when I came out of there, I was, you know, feeling so peaceful, as you do a lot of times. And, you know, everyone I ran into told me, like the cashier at Starbucks was telling me, oh, you have an aura of peacefulness about you.
Ooh.
All sorts of things. And like, it just seemed like everyone was like smiling at me, and I was smiling back like all weekend. And then today I had some time to, and I was going to, you know, go on a long walk, because that's something I, you know, tend to do if I have time. So I thought on the walk, okay, well, let me turn this into a walking meditation. The entire time, I was thinking about people who bothered me, annoying things that happened like a year ago, annoying things that will happen that I have to deal with later. It must have been like 20 times or so, because the walk was about an hour, that I was like, gosh, why is this happening? I just did the day long 2 days ago. Why am I not able to quiet my mind down? So anyway, so that was really refreshing hearing that you just kind of have to accept the, you know, accept the failure, quote unquote, and keep going.
Mm.
I thought it was really bizarre. So
yes, well, you know, I will give you a pass here, because what happens when we do day longs and we do retreats is oftentimes we get still enough to see other things. And that's all you're doing is seeing. That's why you have this upbeat, jovial, keep at it practice, and not make it about whether or not you're good enough or not. Because you're going to see a lot of the negativity before you get down into the level playing field. You see? So you don't want to get caught up on all this negativity as if you're doing something wrong. It's not really about you. You're just seeing, oh, this is what it's like when the mind is just grumbly, grumbly, grumbly. And you want it to feel how uncomfortable that is, which means that you have to feel that uncomfortability. But still, the point is, you want the mind to say, to begin to see, oh, this is not, this is suffering. This is not comfortable. But the meditation was so peaceful. It will figure out how to do that, how to stay within that context. But you have to let it feel both of them. You can't only feel the good, because you will stumble into the suffering part, and you won't be able to get out. So you have to learn to feel both of them and be okay with both of them. It's not a right wrong. It's just one is suffering. You can think of it as one is unskillful and one is skillful.
Good. Thank you. That makes a lot of sense.
You're welcome. Good. Charlotte, how about you?
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm going to keep my camera off, sorry, because my connection is not so good today.
Oh, no problem.
Thank you. I have a question for you about abandoning unskillful action. So there's some unskillful action in my life that I think I can clock that right away and let it go. You know, there's certain things where it comes up and I feel like I can see that and I can let those things go or cultivate something else. But there's other unskillful action in my life that I am not self-aware about. Like, it'll persist in my life and I it'll take me a long time to notice it. And so my question is about cultivating an awareness of that, like before I can even let it go. Like, I don't even see myself doing it sometimes.
Yep.
And then when I do, I have frustration or other things about that. Could you talk to me a little about that?
Yeah, this is what my getting my way, that's why I use that as an example, is because I didn't see the wrongfulness of it. I didn't even think it was unskillful. It takes a while to feel the suffering of it. That's what you're trying to do. So what I would recommend is these behaviors that you're talking about, you have seen them as unskillful. You just can't feel yourself doing it. And so it's more of a saying to yourself, if I see myself doing this, this is unskillful. It doesn't feel unskillful, but this is unskillful. This is what ultimately I ended up doing, is saying that if I felt any kind of pressure, I would immediately assume I'm trying to get my way. And I had this vow that said I was going to give up the need to have my way. So every time I would feel this kind of pressure, I would associate that with trying to get my way. And that I would immediately give it up, let someone else have their way. So what you have to do is sense into what is that unskillful. You kind of know what it is. And you don't need to pick a whole bunch of them. You know, it could be a whole bunch. Don't pick a whole bunch. One is sufficient. just one, that's all you need, and sense into it and say, okay, this one seems like you know, something I could deal with. And then just think of something that would be the counter to it. So you know, it could be kindness, it could be you know, it could be just like you get angry at people or whatever, and you're not really, you get angry at yourself. So, you know, you do something, somebody does something, instead of you yelling at them, which would probably be a good thing, you yell at you. And so, but you notice that you are yelling at yourself, right? So once you declare that as your unskillful behavior, you are not trying to stop that behavior, because this is what I kept stumbling into. If I tried to just stop my unskillful behavior, abandon it before I did anything else, it would never work. I would never abandon it. So you actually want to just recognize the behavior, whatever it is, and cultivate something skillful. It could be, whenever I see myself doing this, I am going to kind of like focus on the breath or focus on my hearing or feel my body sitting wherever, feel the body's posture. Those are all skillful things because they bring you into the present moment. So you just find something that you can have as an alternative, skillful means, and cultivate that. Eventually, in the mind body's own time, you will abandon that unskillfulness. But the only way it works, which is why the framing is so important, is you have to be willing to practice this as a practice. So when I see this, I'm going to do that. And then every time I do that, I'm going to dwell on, look at you. Look what you did. You did that. Look at you. You counted your breath 5 times. I used to give myself what I called, because I had so much anxiety, I gave myself what I called my 1 minute moment of enlightenment. And what that meant was I could be enlightened. All I had to do was stay with 1 minute. And I would look at my clock, my watch, and count down the little red line going around until I had done it for 1 minute. And that was it. And then I would go watch TV, go eat, go do something else. But for 1 minute, I would sit there and just be with that anxiety. That I didn't know was right effort. But it's right effort because I'm cultivating something skillful. And then by calling it my 1 minute of enlightenment, I'm dwelling on this thing that I'm doing. And so this all you're looking for is something you can use to be skillful and then dwell on doing that. And then as time goes on, the mind itself will learn to lean into the dwelling on the goodness. Okay? We'll take two more. I'm going to take one down here, and I have one. We may get to you. It just depends on how long I take to answer.
Since I had the question, you've, I think, addressed it, but basically I was trying to understand, like, when I'm ruminating or perseverating on, like, a thought, and I'm just, like, locked in a loop, and I just can't get out of my own, like, logic, because I just keep spiraling through and back up to the top again. But I think what you're saying is you look at your watch or cultivate something different, right?
That's right. You need a present moment. You know you're ruminating, and that's in the mind. Mm. You need a present moment. Mm. So you have to find something to anchor on. And it doesn't have to be something like the breath, because the breath when you're ruminating is too subtle. It's too hard. So it could be something that feels really good. Mm-hmm. So like I probably shouldn't say this out loud, but I maybe, it's about time I came clean. I went to my friend's house and her baby had this little chick that felt so good. It was a duck. It felt so good. And I stole it, took it with me. I put it. She one time, she said, I cannot find that little duck. Me neither. Might as well bring my comma out with it. But it felt so good. I could hold it and it felt so pleasant. Mm. So find something that's pleasant. If you like essential oils and you can handle smells, find an oil that you really like the way it smells. Mm. Carry it with you and smell it. You just want something that's in the present moment with your sense doors that is a counter to this ruminating mind. And it has to be something pleasant, and it has to be something that uses the other sense doors. So it could be a touch, it could be smell, it could be a sight, it could be anything. Yeah, good. And then there was a hand online, but I see it's gone. So that means you. Good. One last question.
Thanks, Tawari.
You're
So I'm having this thought about how when you said just focus on one thing, I was like, okay, no, that's not going to work for me because I got a lot of stuff to work on here. I got like a list I'm working with. So I was kind of feeling that feeling and being and trying to figure out like, why am I so attached to this idea? I'm going to be able to fix all these things about myself. And I thought maybe you could talk to me about that because I have the sense that that's not really the purpose of this.
That's right. It's not.
And I need to be convinced of why that is. Right.
Because you don't actually need to be fixed. That's the thing we don't understand. Everything we're doing is out of habit. We're not doing it. It's just something our kids figured out when we were very little. We thought this is what we're supposed to do, and we just start doing it. And now the mind just does it without us even, and we just drag along with it. So if you, that's why the Buddha's non-self was so freeing. Because if you take this on as you, then it's, your mind will never be convinced that you can be something other than who you are. You are. I thought of myself as an angry person. I could never not be an angry person. I could be a controlled angry person, but I have to always be an angry person because that's who I am. Unless you begin to see, like I saw, that my anger is not me. It's just a habit. And if it's a habit, you can change it. You can break it. You can rearrange it and stop doing that habit. But if it's you, then you're never going to be able to stop it because this is who you are. And you won't know who you are if you stop doing it. So why would you stop? So instead, what you're trying to do is to wrap this in practice. It's practice. And you are practicing cultivating a wisdom mind, a mind that sees some things are okay, some things just bring a lot of harm, some things don't. You can do it. You can do all your same habits, but you want to know if it brings harm or not. And if it brings harm, then you're less likely to want to do it. But you won't be able to stop that unless you can see the harm. So not good or bad, just this brings harm and this doesn't. And you can cultivate things that don't bring harm and enjoy it. You can see that I do things that bring harm still to this day. I can see that, but I am far more likely to just immediately apologize. I can see the harm. I'm not ashamed of it. And I can admit it. I don't have to hide it. I don't have to do any of that because I've seen my goodness so much that I know the harm is getting less and less and less. Not because I'm getting better, 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 because I probably act the same way I've always acted, but I can recognize the harm much quicker and I can stop. I don't have a problem just stopping mid-argument because of the harm that can come from it. You see, but it comes from being willing to feel that harm for a little while I learn, while the mind learned, this is skillful, this is not. And it doesn't know that automatically because we were kids and we watched the way adults did it and that's the way we did it. So we have to learn. My parents were both very angry. So I learned to be angry too. But we have to learn, I have to choose, I don't want to be that way. I could just follow my parents, but I don't want to. And not because they're good people, bad people, I just don't want to be that way. So I had to learn, this is anger, it's unskillful, it's not what I want to be, and move in harmony with the way I want to be. But that is a learned behavior. It's not a good person, bad person, you're good, you're not. It's a learned behavior. And so you're just cultivating skillful means that is a learned behavior that you'll start doing more often as you start, you know, paying attention to how you're feeling. But you have to be willing to feel the what you don't like that's unwholesome or unskillful, and then feel and dwell on what it's like when you do something wholesome, when you do something skillful. You have to dwell on that so the mind doesn't just flip it off as, you know, no big deal, just a random accident that you happen to be nice. You see? Good. All right, you guys. That was fantastic. Thank you so much for being here.